12 minutes after the hour of 9 a.m. We apologize for the delay getting started this morning. It was not avoidable. And we have Portia Parker with us this morning from the Department of Corrections. Portia, welcome to the Judiciary Committee. And this is your program, so if you'll please proceed.
Thank you.
I should say we have Senator Davis, Senator Huggins, Senator Terrio, Senator Wagner, and Senator Ellis Elton with us this morning.
Chairman Seekins, Chairman Terrio, we really appreciate this joint committee to be able to give this presentation. For the record, I'm Portia Parker with the Department of Corrections. We have experts, national experts in the field of sex offender management and supervision here from the state of Colorado. They present all over the country and help jurisdictions with the containment approach as well as have extensive research on this model for containing sex offenders. I will have the three experts will come up and introduce themselves for the record, and then they'll go through the presentation. I have asked that they go quickly through the beginning part of the presentation, which is more of the statistics on the problem, and get right into what we propose as a solution or to help with this problem. So at this time, I'd like to invite Kim English, Peggy Heil, and Jeff Jenks up to begin the presentation. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting us. You have a copy of the original presentation, and I'm skipping some of the early slides, so you can't go exactly, but I'll tell you when we sort of hook up, because we just wanted to save some time. You have the information there if you want to reference it later. So I'm skipping, I think, probably the first six or seven slides. You're probably on the next page or two. What we would like to start with is just to sort of remind you that this is a very important issue. I know that you're aware of how important this problem is. We wanted to sort of underscore that the personal and social costs of sexual assault are very high. This is what motivates us to try to find better and better ways of managing this population. We know from studies of sexual assault victims that more than half of sexual assault victims have been raped more than once. That's either one episode where a person could be raped multiple times over the duration of the assault period, or you could have a single person who is assaulted multiple times for many years. People who are recovering from sexual assault are six times more likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder. Maybe you know that is, those are night sweats, unable to sleep, nightmares, very high anxiety. It's a very, very uncomfortable place to live in your body. They are three times more likely to develop major depression, and they're 13 times more likely to attempt suicide. The social and personal costs of sexual assault are very high, and the containment approach really tries to keep in mind the damage done, the harm done, and proactively figure out ways of preventing future assaults by known offenders, offenders who've actually made it into our system. To really understand what we're trying to do with the containment approach, it's really important to understand that very few victims report this crime. Only 16% of victims in the classic Rape in America study reported the rape. And this is rape as defined by the FBI. So it's penetration or attempted penetration. And this was a health study conducted by researchers at the Medical University of South Carolina. There are a number of studies like this that look at the proportion of victims who reported the crime, and it's always very low, between 10 and 16, 17, 18 percent.
Yes. Senator French.
Yes.
You know, a statistic like that always brings to mind for a lot of folks, if such a small number of people are reporting, how do you know? That is, if only 16% report, what makes you know what the total number is to understand that only a small percentage are actually reporting?
That's a very good question. What researchers do is take a random sample of the population or some jurisdiction. It's been done in L.A. County, for example. Our sexual assault coalition did one for the state of Colorado. And ask, you ask men and women who end up in your sample a number of questions, one of which is, have you ever been sexually assaulted? Then you define what the sexual assault is, and then you ask whether or not that crime was reported. So you don't know exactly how much. You can make estimates based on what happened to the folks who report to you. You can estimate the proportion of abuse in the larger population. This is so disturbing, though, to me, because that tells me that folks who end up in the criminal justice system and end up in my sample, I'm a researcher. Peggy's is a therapist, and Jeff is a polygraph examiner. So we come at this from multiple disciplines. And from my perspective, I was thinking, how is it that folks end up in my sample if only 16% are reporting? What's different about them than the folks that we never see? If you take a good look at the victim's literature, there is a bit of a description about who these folks are. The victims who report the crime are young, who don't report the crime, are younger in age, and they know the perpetrator. One of the things that we find when we looked at victim survey is that 60 to 65% of victims are below the age of 18. Offenders select victims who are unlikely to report. It's part of what they do. And they groom victims to not report. So we're ending up with people in the criminal justice system who, for some reason, chose the wrong victim. And that victim reported the crime. We know from the victim studies that folks who are more likely to report the crime to authority felt that their life was in danger, had physical injury, so that there was actual proof that something happened to them, proof to somebody besides themselves, and the perpetrator was a stranger. So folks who end up in the criminal justice system do look different from folks that don't, and they're more likely to have selected a victim that was empowered to tell. When you ask victims why they don't report, they'll say that they're afraid of being blamed. And children are afraid of being disbelieved. So we have very few people reporting the crime. And once the crime is reported, only a quarter to a third of those reported sex crimes result in an arrest. And in Colorado, we've analyzed whether or not what the likelihood of conviction is. Once they have been arrested and filed on in district court, then about half the time to 70% of the time, they are actually convicted of a sex crime. So what you're seeing is this incredible funnel of the folks ending up in the system being primarily driven by victim reporting. But we already know that the victims are already traumatized. And so one of the things that we're trying to do with the containment approach is take the responsibility for reporting and discussing and talking about the number of sex crimes out there off of the victim and place it on the offender. We'll talk about that in just a minute. So when you look at recidivism rates for sex offenders, lots of times people are trying to sort of quell public fear about this population, and they'll quote lots of studies that show that recidivism rates of this population are quite low. They are actually quite low. But now we understand that it requires that a victim reported the crime. It requires that the person was arrested. And it requires that the person was convicted. And so those rates are always going to look fairly low. Incest, as you can see from this slide, those are the folks that appear to have the lowest recidivism rates. But we know from the victim surveys that those are the victims that are least likely to report the crime. And so in the criminal justice system, traditionally, we think of incest perpetrators as being the lowest risk of sex offenders. And maybe they're not very risky at all once those kids grow older and are out of the house. Maybe they'll become risky again at the point of grandchildren, but that's a generation away. Well, the data that I'm going to show you suggests that that's not at all the case. Incest perpetrators, someone who harms their own children, are probably at great risk for harming somebody else's. So a goal of containment is to obtain and share information. It's very difficult to get information because it's a very secret and shameful activity. Victims don't report, offenders don't want to tell you. So what we're going to describe to you is a method for accessing as much information about the offender as possible. The core of the containment approach are a number of policies, which is what you see on the side, and I'll briefly go through those. But the three anchors on the ends of the triangle are what we'll be talking about today in more detail. The polygraph is to sex offender management what drug testing is to drug offender supervision. It's a verification of whether or not the person is complying with treatment. It's another piece of information. It's another tool for managing the population. Treatment is, as Peggy will talk about, Jeff is going to talk to you about the polygraph. Peggy will talk to you about treatment and how treatment is used not only to try to give the offender tools for changing behavior, but also to obtain information to help prevent that individual offender from perpetrating against new victims, that we try to get very individual, specific information about each offender so that you can set up a very detailed and individualized treatment plan and supervision plan. And then the criminal justice system brings together the polygraph examination and the treatment provider. The criminal justice system says, hey, this guy is under my supervision, I have jurisdiction over the offender, and I want a treatment provider that is going to use the polygraph as part of treatment. And I want somebody who's had X kind of training and who's going to do X kind of treatment that has been found in the research to be most effective with this population. That's not the only thing, though, that you have to have in place to manage sex offenders. You really need to think through, and the Department of Corrections has done an excellent job of trying to think through what these protocols need to be. Yesterday we did a presentation that included folks from folks in the audience from Child Services, which is so important because there are issues about family reunification with sex offenders. And in the criminal justice system, typically, until fairly recently, folks have thought of a rapist as a rapist and a child molester as a child molester. And so rapists, of course, would be given contact with children without thinking much about it because they didn't assault children. Well, we're not so sure, as you see, that that's actually the case. And so family reunification becomes a major issue. You have law enforcement registration. You'll have urinalysis testing. You'll have GPS monitoring. You'll monitor their leisure time. You'll have employment restrictions. I won't go through all of these for you, but this I want you to sort of get an understanding that it's sort of a web that you put around the offender with lots and lots of structure to help them learn how to live a non-secret life, how to live a life out in the open, while at the same time not taking any chances regarding public safety. The criminal justice system provides the hammer, and one of the ways we'll talk about that while we're here this week will be the fact that we need to have consequences for failed polygraph examinations. When someone, let me just say, Jeff will talk to you more in detail, but it's easy to pass a polygraph exam. It's easy to pass one. You just need to be telling the truth. That might be the hard part. So we know that many offenders don't pass these exams right off the bat. They will eventually pass them. But when they don't pass them, then we need to have consequences, and that's the job of the criminal justice system. The treatment provider and the polygraph examiner can't invoke consequences, but the criminal justice system can. The consequences need to be immediate, even if it means that they have to go do an extra therapy session or pay for an additional polygraph exam. These are natural consequences that follow the fact that the person was lying in the process and not complying with the court order or the parole order to be engaged in treatment. So you will always increase surveillance of the offender and try to learn more. You use the polygraph findings as a red flag for where you want to go and look more. That's where you're going to want to do a home visit. That's where you're going to want to talk to family members. We know from this study of by Canadian researchers that sex offenders who failed parole supervision were different from those who successfully completed supervision in these ways. They tended to see themselves as not being a risk, so they minimized how dangerous they might be. They had a history of diverse victim types. We're going to talk a little bit more about that in a second. They had fewer months in the community. These folks tended to fail quickly when they didn't have the structure that they needed. They had access to victims. This is what the containment approach tries to do, is stop giving offenders opportunities to offend. And so we try to restrict access to potential victims. They had attitudes of sexual entitlement, and they had poor social influences, just like sort of all criminals. That's a risk factor for all criminals. Let me quickly go through some of the things that we've learned from studies with sex offenders. This is the first time that Peggy and I collaborated. Peggy was working at the Department of Corrections at the prison, and I was working in the Department of Public Safety. We have a research unit there. And we collaborated. She was implementing the polygraph for the first time in the prison system. And we were collaborating on what information you've learned from the polygraph so we could actually quantify it. And we had data collectors who went in and gathered from the file what was known at the point of sentencing, so what the judge knew. And then what we learned from going through a treatment assignment, which is called the sex history, and Peggy will talk a little bit about that, where they need to describe their sex history over time so that you get a picture of exactly how and who and how frequently they've offended in the past. So they start with their first offense and go forward. And I've seen these sex histories in the file that were started out being like a paragraph long, and several months into treatment, they're 50 pages long. So this is what we were learning, that the number of victims is the first column here, and the number of offenses is the second column. So I'm just going to focus you on the number of victims. Now, first of all, these are hands-on and hands-off crimes. Hands-off crimes are voyeurism, exhibitionism, and so those are crimes that you can do quite frequently and never get reported. These do include hands-on crimes, and they're most likely to be serving time for a hands-on crime, obviously. So what the court knew, what the judge knew at the time of sentencing, was that on average, this group had two victims. And the number in parentheses is the median, which is the midpoint of if you have everybody. There were 35 offenders in this study, this small study, and each of them said what they the number of victims they had, and the midpoint of that is you might have like 20 people saying that they had one victim, and then you might have somebody out here saying that they have 40 victims. And so you try to show people both the average number, which is the number that we're used to looking at, and then the median. The sex history, after they wrote out everything that they had done since they started assaulting people, the number of victims jumps up to 83, with the median being 21. That's the midpoint. There are some guys out here in this study who are saying that they committed a couple thousand crimes, sex crimes. And in large part, some of those were exhibitionists, and those were the guys that were passing the polygraph. So that made it very complicated for me as a researcher, because usually what you do when you have these things called, we call them outliers, and you cut them out, and then you have a footnote and say, for some reason, we had these very strange, you know, responses of a couple of guys who said they did more than 2,000 or 3,000 crimes. Well, we couldn't do that here because these were the guys that were passing the polygraph. So at the point of the sex history, we learned how many times, you know, we learned 40 times the number of victims. Then that doubles at the point of the first polygraph. it's increasing exponentially as they go through the process of disclosure that incorporates a very specific treatment method that is focused on gathering information about the individual and then combining that with polygraph, and the polygraph sort of encouraging them to be truthful. And as you see, as they go through it, they're disclosing more victims, not fewer victims. 70% of the guys in the sample were still failing the polygraph. So we think that these numbers are still conservative, remarkable as they are. Now, this is a larger sample of 223 sex offenders, and these are only hands-on crimes. So we're trying to narrow it down. Hands-off crimes can be traumatizing if they are continually inflicted on a family member, for example. So we don't minimize hands-off crimes, but these are hands-on crimes. Here's what we knew at the top. The first column is what the court knew when the person came before the court to get sentenced to DOC. That only 7% of this 200 plus group of sex offenders had assaulted both adult and child victims. So we knew that was a very few. That appears to be a very unusual and unique subset that would cross age groups. But using the polygraph, that jumped to 70%. And these folks are still, a large proportion of these folks are still being found deceptive on the polygraph. Now, a lot of people think a male-oriented pedophile is riveted on kids, fixated on boys. But what we found is that at least a third of this group has crossed over male and female victims. That's why we call it crossing over. They're crossing over what you typically assume to be these categories. And multiple relationships is really an important one that doesn't get talked about very often. In this case, there were four categories of relationships, and they were all independent of each other. One was incest. One was position of trust. One was acquaintance. And one was stranger. So we tend to think that incest perpetrators may be only at risk for their own children. And we think that stranger rapists only attack strangers. This showed that 86% of the sample had crossed over relationships. So the idea that we were typing these folks as a rapist is a rapist, a child molester is a child molester, a male-oriented pedophile is only going to be at risk to little boys, this is shattering those notions that we have these discrete subtypes and subgroups of sex offenders. Further, they're still lying. Half of these guys anyway are still lying. They're still not giving it all up. So we know these numbers are really conservative. This is a study that I did on behalf of the National Institute of Justice, which is the research arm of the U.S. Department of Justice. And we were able to go outside of Colorado and look at data from Texas, in this case, Texas, Wisconsin, and Oregon. And we had in this sample 180 convicted sex offenders whose conviction crime was incest. Those are the folks that we hope are the lowest risk and are only, if you keep them away from their family or do supervised visitation, that this person is somebody we can manage really well. So we looked at the record of data that was obtained from the polygraph information, from the polygraph in these sites, and we found that a third had assaulted strangers. Now, these were incest perpetrators. A third had assaulted strangers. And again, 70% were not passing the polygraph. Over half had assaulted from a position of trust. And if you look at the victims' literature, a lot of incest victims, studies of incest victims, will say that their perpetrator also harmed a neighbor or somebody during the sleepover. So it seems to be about access and opportunity, as opposed to any particular preference, which is what the field often thinks of, is, the, oh, these folks have a real preference, and so that's who we need to keep them from contacting. But this is a crime of opportunity, these data suggest. A third of the incest, those who were convicted of incest had assaulted adult victims. So we're beginning to understand now that the way that most of the world talks about sex offenders, including the research world, the rapist, here's the recidivism rate. The incest perpetrator, here's the recidivism rate. The child molester, here's the recidivism rate. We now know that that is an artificial way of describing who these folks are. We know from the research that these offenders that at least end up in our study samples started at a young age. The first three numbers up here on age of onset, 18, 15, and 16, those were self-report studies where the offenders were offered confidentiality. And you're looking at about 16 years old, right? The bottom three are polygraph studies. And we're looking at a much younger age of onset. And what you have to think about is how the brain doesn't stop sort of building itself until it's in its early 20s. And so we're seeing this fusion of pleasure and harm to others from a really early age. And that's getting patterned in the brain. The idea that we're going to put somebody in a treatment program for 6 months and they're going to be okay, what is the likelihood of that happening? We're talking about very long-term treatment. In Colorado, we have something called lifetime supervision for certain classifications of sex crimes, because we believe there's no cure. We have no evidence that you can cure this behavior, but it can be managed, just like blood pressure, having high blood pressure. We want to manage the population, but we want to manage the population for a very long time. There's no graduation from a treatment program. There's participation and engagement in the treatment for the duration of your life until you've passed so many polygraphs that you've been crime-free. We're certain that you've been crime-free for so long that we think maybe you've begun to establish, you've begun to recognize how good it feels to be law-abiding and no longer secretive. So we believe this is a hugely humane approach, and that it offers the best opportunity for both victims to be protected and for offenders to live a different life. The average lag time in detection then corresponds with that early onset, and when they choose a victim that's empowered to report, because they get more and more confident over time. Well, so maybe it shouldn't be such a surprise that these guys are so busy with hundreds of crimes over the course of a lifetime when they've been at it for 15, 20 years before we get them. You just had a person, I believe, who made the papers in Anchorage, maybe? I'm not sure where. It was a couple weeks ago, where he was 61 years old and said he had been offending for 40 years. And he was sent to the Department of Corrections. That's a lot of victims. Jeff is going to talk to you now about how the polygraph works. So I'll leave you with sort of this umbrella idea that we're very concerned about victims, the fact that this is very secret and shameful and harmful behavior, and that when we have a lot of information, that we're best equipped to help manage each individual offender with the web of policies and then individualized treatment plans based on information that you can get from the polygraph. We'll be happy to take questions now.
Before she leaves, Mr. Chair, Kim, you talked about your research, but several times you mentioned therapy, and Peggy might want to address this too when she does her presentation. But I'm wondering if your containment program is predicated, the success of that is predicated to some extent on therapies that happen during incarceration.
And if there is a, if there's a link, and if containment is, works better, if in fact you're getting somebody that has been given some tools before they're released?
We think that there, that we have some data that, that suggests from Colorado, where Peggy ran the treatment, she developed the sex offender treatment program and ran a very intense sex offender treatment program in Colorado for 20 years.
And in the prison system?
Yes, in the prison system. And we, since we're in a different department, like I mentioned, and so we got a grant, a research grant, to evaluate it. And she's going to show you some of the outcome findings. And what you see is, if you do get treatment in prison, there's some huge benefits. First of all, she'll probably talk about how they act out less. So you have fewer disciplinary problems in prison because they're engaging in this treatment process. And the parole officers say, oh my gosh, the guys that come out of Peggy's program, they are so much easier when they hit the street than they than the guys that don't. And so it saves this, there's this huge resource save. But then they have to be, you will see that they absolutely have to have supervision and treatment and containment in the community. So the continuum is the ideal, as long as the continuum is linked with the community piece and it's not based on a cure. We can't be thinking about how many people completed the program. It's not, that's not a good measure. We don't want people to complete. We don't want them to think they can complete. We do not want them to be sitting back. So Peg will talk to you a little bit more about that.
One other question for you.
Thank you.
Your experience with the sex offender registration program?
Yes.
Yeah, could you just expound on your thoughts?
Sex offender registration over the years has gotten confused and commingled, so to speak, with sex offender notification. Sex offender registration originally was requiring offenders to go down to local law enforcement and say where they were living. That's a very good idea. And many people did that long before the feds came. Many jurisdictions did that long before the feds came in and said, if you don't do it, we're going to take some money away from you. Law enforcement registration is an investigation tool. But what happened at the federal level is the idea that Megan Kanka, who was walked across the street and was succumbed to a puppy, and went into the house across the street of, and was sexually assaulted and killed because a known sex offender was living there. That mom, her mother, said, we need to have the community knowing where these guys are living. And so there needs to be something called community notification, because if I had known that sex offenders were living across the street from me, Megan would have never been allowed over there. That's debatable, just because of that darn puppy, that Megan wouldn't have found a way over there anyway. But the community notification piece, for example, Oregon had been doing community notification on an as-needed basis for years. And then the feds came in and said law enforcement needs to do community notification. It's not going to happen by probation or parole or however else you might be wanting to do it. And so law enforcement was supposed to be doing registration, and law enforcement was supposed to be doing notification. And those two things came together. Does that make sense? Is that not, crimes do get solved that way, but the access to the information is public as opposed to just law enforcement. That didn't answer your question, did it?
Well, no, let me make sure I got your message. It sounds like you're saying that by commingling the two processes that maybe we have reduced the effectiveness of one or both.
I think that's exactly
right. With the agency, in this case, law enforcement.
Exactly. I think that's true. And Peggy's going to talk about some of the methods that she has used to enhance law enforcement's involvement in containment that goes way beyond registration.
So, but your answer, if what we're doing now is not working, what is the answer for Megan?
That was a very complicated case. He actually had the guy that assaulted her and killed her had a long history and had two prior prison convictions. What happened with that offender is that the district attorney pled that case down. He should have still been in prison. And there was no reason why he couldn't have been in prison, because that guy had two prior prison sentences for a sex crime. So we have to be paying attention and not pleading down serious sexual assaults. He had already done time for rape. There's no need to plead that down. So he did 4 years instead of the 20 years that he was supposed to do.
That night, Mr. Chair, one follow-up. It appears to me this is based only on reading the paper. Senator French here is a former prosecutor, might be expound on his experience, but that the syndrome of pleading down is alive, well, and on a rampage.
Well, it's not such a bad thing most of the time, because there are a lot of reasons why it's a good thing to plead down. What you don't want to plead down to is a non-sex crime. You want to keep that in the family of sex crimes, for one thing. And you want to make sure that that's an aggravated sentence. And so he just fell through the cracks. That guy got lucky because some prosecutor just wasn't paying attention that day. That Jesse Aramijo should still be in prison, and Megan should be 25 years old. So we have to watch all aspects of the system is all.
Thank you. Well, for the record, Senator Guest joined us during the presentation, and I did neglect to say that this is a joint committee meeting, State Affairs and Judiciary. So, Jeff, welcome to the Joint Committee of Judiciary and State Affairs for the
Thank
State
you.
Senate.
Thank
if you'll put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
My name is Jeff Jenks. I'm president and owner of Amichan Jenks Incorporated, a polygraph firm in Wheat Ridge, Colorado. We're thrilled to be here in sunny and warm Juneau. Didn't know you had this kind of weather year-round, but understand. I'm going to be talking about the polygraph. I began doing polygraphs 1978, and to date have conducted over 34,000 examinations, most of which have been with sex offenders. Prior to 1989 in Colorado, most of my work was pre-adjudicated sex offenders. In other words, I was doing investigations for DAs, police departments, law enforcement agencies, even defense attorneys, where I would test their clients to determine whether or not they had actually committed the offense they were being arrested for. Post-conviction testing brought on a whole new light to my work. Pre-conviction testing, I was focusing just on the offense itself. I was not going in any sexual paraphilias that they may have committed, any sexual acts they may have committed outside of their offense itself. Once the post-conviction arena came into play, which was 1989 in the state of Colorado. Now, the state of Washington and Oregon had been doing it for several years before we did in Colorado. But once we got into it, we realized just how busy these individuals are and the crossover behavior and the number of sexual paraphilias and sexual offenses they've actually been involved in. I was amazed. As a polygraph examiner, I too was under the assumption that the rapist was only the rapist, that these guys didn't necessarily prey on children, and vice versa, that those who preyed on children didn't necessarily go out and commit violent sex crimes. And it did not take me long to learn that they in fact do cross over and they in fact do these things. The polygraph, and I'll go into briefly how it works, the reliability and accuracy of it. If you take reliability and accuracy out of the equation, and you just look at the amount of information that we obtain from these individuals sitting in a small room with them, hooked up to a polygraph examination, just the free-flowing information that we get from them, which is a very non-accusatory. If I were to show you a videotape of a polygraph, it actually is quite a long and boring process to watch and listen to, but the amount of information that we obtain has just been astronomical, particularly to the therapists that we do work for. Sex offenders, we've also found, become both a very good polygraph subject and a very bad polygraph subject. They're very good in that they have the fear of detection. They have been living a life of secrecy their entire lives in the community, their church, their spouses. It's not something they've ever talked about usually until they've gotten caught, and now they're having to talk about it. They become very good polygraph subjects. Where they are not good polygraph subjects is that they are extremely manipulative individuals. It's probably the most difficult type of polygraph to do, and because of that, training is very important for polygraph examiners. And the state of Colorado is doing a very good job in getting very qualified examiners up here to do this work. But because of that, and when I say manipulative, they rationalize. They rationalize more than any other criminal I've ever tested, more than murderers, thieves, arsonists. They rationalize their behavior. It is not their fault that they molested their 12-year-old daughter. It's their wife's fault because she let her dress in a certain way. It's the daughter's fault because she's coming on to him. It's society's fault because they allow these TV shows and movies to be on a regular basis where sexual exploitation is shown. It's everyone's fault but their own. But we play that to our advantage, and that's how we get a lot of admissions in the polygraph process, by letting them play that card during the polygraph process. Then eventually through therapy, they work with these individuals till they ultimately take responsibility themselves and realize what it's doing to the victim by still blaming the victim themselves. The polygraph works on the fear of detection. If I were just to test somebody and they had no concern about the outcome of the test, the polygraph is not going to be an effective tool. These individuals do have a concern about that. The fight or flight response kicks into their autonomic nervous system, which is what we measure. Blood pressure, pulse rate, blood volume, galvanic skin response, which is an electrical current that we measure through electrodes on the fingertips, and finally the respiratory patterns. Prior to 1989, the only type of polygraphs we ever did were what you see on TV with the ink and the needles flowing up and down. The computerized polygraph came in from Department of Defense in 1989, where that has been a huge advantage to polygraph is that it's not just the examiner scoring the charts. It's complicated mathematical algorithms from Johns Hopkins University that are built into the computer that also analyze our data based on a database of tens of thousands of examinations that they've plugged in. Johns Hopkins touts it at over 99%. I don't tout anything at over 99%. There is nothing that is perfect, and certainly polygraph falls into that realm. However, based upon good question formulation from the examiner, a well-founded interview and interrogation approach, and the polygraph results themselves, our accuracy rating is right around the 95 to 98 percentile rate with these individuals, depending on the type of test that we're dealing with, and I'll get into that in a little bit. The accuracy of the National Academy of Sciences in 2003 set a medium accuracy for the polygraph at 89%. The very low was 70, the very high was 99% on these studies. What you need to keep in mind with these studies is the 70%, the 70 to 90 percentile range were much different type of polygraphs than what we're utilizing with the sex offenders. The low percentage rate there dealt with pre-employment testing. And pre-employment testing encompasses up to 20 relevant questions that we're testing individuals on. And the accuracy rating does fall because of that, because of the sheer number of questions that we're testing them on. In the pre-test interview, before we actually start the test, we're asking them many, many different questions based on their paraphilias. Once we get to the test itself, we're narrowing it down to 2 to 3 relevant questions that we're rendering opinions on. Sometimes 4 at the outset, but almost always it's 2 to 3 relevant questions that we're rendering opinions on. We did that. We set those standards for a reason. And the reason is accuracy and reliability. The less you ask these individuals, the more accurate the test is going to be on the in-test phase itself. Now, if any of you do have questions as you go along, feel free to ask.
Jeff, I'm curious on the accuracy. I mean, does accuracy come down because some individuals always or nearly always fool the system? Fool is probably not the scientific word.
Right.
So that some people are always going to have a reliable reading on them all the time, but you have a few individuals that are very tough.
That is part of the accuracy. However, usually the accuracy comes down because of examiner fault and error, and that because question formulation is improper for these individuals. You almost have to think like a sex offender as a polygraph examiner testing a sex offender, and you have to see how they could possibly rationalize out of a particular question. And therefore, you have to deal with only what they've done, not their reasons why they did it, not their rationalizations. And when you have examiners trying to get into their rationalizations and why they did something, whether they did it on purpose or it was somebody else's fault, the accuracy is going to drop on the polygraph at that particular point in time. You do have that category of individuals that for one reason or another is just not going to be testable. However, once again, that's examiner error because of the building control questions that we have, which is in the in-test phase. You'll see tucked inside 2 or 3 comparison questions. if you have an individual that comes on and is non-responsive to the relevant questions, have they had physical sexual contact with more than five individuals under the age of 15 since they turned 18? That would be a question that would be asked. If they're unresponsive to that, however, they're still unresponsive to the control questions, you have an inconclusive test. You don't have someone who's passing. An inexperienced examiner may look at that, however, and say, he's not responding to these questions, therefore he must be telling the truth. And that's what brings the accuracy level down also. It would be a false positive or false negative at that point in time. With the pretest interview, when someone comes in for the test, pretest interview is extremely important. We review their medical conditions because it is a medical recording device that we're using. They sign release and consent forms. We explain the purpose of the exam. We review the equipment. We review terminology. This is extremely important for sex offenders, that the therapist, the parole and probation officer, and the polygraph examiner all are using the same definitions for what is a physical sexual contact, what is a forced sexual contact. And we want to make sure the offender knows what we're talking about when we use those definitions also, and we use the legal definitions of physical sexual contact. That means if they see a minor that they objectify on the bus, they don't touch them, they just see them, they're thinking sexually about them, that's not a physical sexual contact. If they brush by the shoulder of a minor or they shake hands with a minor and they're aroused to that activity, that's not physical sexual contact because they're not in contact with sexual organs. We want to make sure everyone is on the same page on that. We develop the final questions. No polygraph is ever administered on these individuals asking trick or surprise questions. They know exactly what questions are going to be asked by the time we get to the in-test phase. By the time we start testing them, we want them to know what questions are being asked, even the order that they're going to be asked in. We don't want surprise responses on the polygraph, which is one response that looks very similar to a deceptive response. That's why we don't hook someone up and say, what is 180 times 360? You're going to get a surprise response, and it's going to look deceptive just because they don't know the answer. You have to make sure they understand the question, they can verbalize it back to you, what it means, and that they can give you a yes or no answer on that. The in-test phase, once again, 2 to 4 relevant questions tucked inside 2 to 3 comparison questions. Relevant questions must be very specific to the offense. Keep in mind with a polygraph, we can measure what a person has done, what a person has said, or what a person has had done to them or said to them, period. We can't test why a person did something, their intent, or anything else. The meet the parents shows, the will you marry my dad shows, complete frauds as far as the polygraph part of it, because they're asking intent questions, and you cannot do that on a reliable polygraph exam. You run a minimum of 3 sets of charts. That's for consistency of responses. We just don't want to look at the response on one test and render an opinion, nor does the computer. The computer has to see at least 3 sets of charts and score and interpret the chart markings. Post-test becomes very important in what we do as polygraphers, and that's once again where the training comes into play. When someone fails my polygraph, if I didn't do anything else and just let that polygraph go out as it is, sex offenders in particular are going to go back and it's going to be a he said thing. You know, they're going to say, I was telling the truth. The polygraph is flawed. It's wrong. And it's going to be an argument at that particular point. The post-test becomes very important in that we get admissions from these individuals on a vast majority of cases. Confession rate in our office is about 90%. That means of the individuals that are failing, 90% of the time, we get a confession on that particular area. It doesn't mean they're telling us the entire truth, but they tell us something that would verify that test result, so we know that that test result was accurate. Once again, it's a very non-evasive type interrogation. It's not the bright light in the eyes or anything else. It's a psychological type interrogation, and if you were to watch on videotape, once again, can be somewhat boring to even watch, but it obtains results and it obtains admissions from these individuals that then go back to the therapist and the probation or parole officer that they expound on that, and then they work on that so that by the next time we see the individual, which is usually 3 to 6 months down the road, those admissions have usually went on from there and have multiplied by the time we see them again. It also gives them an opportunity to explain their deceptive findings. One thing we find with sex offenders is, surprisingly, a lot of times they want to get this information out. They've been holding it so long, they want to get this information out. Purposes of the post-conviction exams vary. We run 3 to 4 primary types of tests with them. The first is the sex history. We're obtaining information on past victims, past methods used to access those victims, need to know their age of onset, when they started doing the crimes themselves, how often they were doing it, and their extent of their crossover behavior. An example of a sex history test would be, since your age of 18, if you had physical sexual contact with anyone else under the age of 15, other than whom you've disclosed. Before we do the sex history, they have to fill out their sex history packets, bring them with them at the time of the test. Another one would be, prior to your age of 18, if you had physical sexual contact with anyone else 4 years or more younger than you, if you had physical sexual contact with any other family members, and forcing individuals to be sexual with them. A specific issue would be the offender who's in denial about their crime itself, and many times this happens. They are in complete denial on their offense itself, or they may be facing a new accusation. Once again, with these individuals that are under denial, 90% of them will leave our offices having confessed to at least part of their crime, maybe not all of it, but to at least part of it. One thing we found with offenders is many times they're willing to admit the offense. They're willing to admit that, yes, I had sexual contact with my 13-year-old daughter, but they're not willing to talk about the force that was used. The 13-year-old may say he tied me up, or he beat me, or he threatened my life, or he threatened my mother's life if I didn't succumb to him. That's the part that they have difficulty time talking about and admitting to us, and many times we do a specific issue on that.
Yes.
Do you discuss at all whether or not they've been victims?
We do. In fact, Peggy had us in the prison system at one time test these individuals as to their veracity to that. There was some suspicion that maybe some of these individuals were saying they were victims to excuse their behavior when in fact they were not. And in fact, we did find a percentage of them that were lying about that. Studies have shown around 50 to 60% of them probably have been abused sometime in their lifetime. So there is a majority of them that have been. But if you go on their personal statements, however, that number jumps up to about 90%. 80 or 90% of them say that they've been victimized. And we found out in that study when we did that, that that was not in fact the case. It was not that high.
What was it? You said 80 or 90%.
That was the percentage that said that they had been assaulted earlier in life by someone. There was a suspicion there that some of them may were not telling the truth, that they were just using that as an excuse for their own behavior. So we polygraphed them on that. Were they actually sexually offended against at an early age by whoever they said they were offended against? And we found about 20 to 30% of them were not telling the truth about that. They, in fact, had not been.
Okay, so something over 50% probably were.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And they can speak better that on the studies in regards to that aspect. The other types of tests we do, the maintenance test. We're checking out assault patterns and behaviors regarding supervision conditions, and we're looking for precursor behaviors. This is while they are on probation or parole. We're testing them every 3 to 6 months to make sure they're not out reoffending or not out committing new crimes, or if they are an internet abuser, we want to test to make sure they're not on the internet, they're not in chat rooms with minors, they're not sending pornography out through the internet, they're not viewing child pornography, they're not having physical sexual contact with minors. With therapeutical purposes, it becomes very important whether or not they're still masturbating to lots of their victims or other minors. And we sometimes will test them on that to determine whether or not they're still doing that or not. The sex history exam, types of past victims, gender, age, the relationship, frequency of assaults, types of behavior, was it voyeurism, rape, child molesting, internet, how they did it. Did they get friendly with a parent? Did they go to church to find single exhausted moms? Were they engaged in obscene phone calls always? Because many times we find that there is a precursor behavior. The guy who makes obscene phone calls then leaves from doing that from his own house and goes out and commits a sex offense after that. So we want to test them whether or not they have engaged in many of those phone calls or if they're still doing it while on probation or parole. Lord, child with a puppy, this happens so often. So while they're on probation or parole, they're not allowed to have pets such as that. And many times they'll do a home visit and they'll find a pet in there and they'll always say, it's not mine, it's somebody else's. So we may test them as to whether or not they actually went out and got a pet. Specific issue exam, once again, when the offender is denying offense or significant aspects, used when there's an allegation. If they're on probation and parole, if there's an allegation that they were spotted at a Colorado Rockies game with a young boy, which happens, those type of things happen all the time, they have one of two things. They can lie about it and say, he wasn't with me, or it wasn't me that you saw there, Or they can tell the truth and say, yes, it was me, and I'd taken my nephew to the game that day. I know it's a violation, but they'll go on from there. If they deny it, which they usually do, they come into our offices for a polygraph to verify whether or not they were there. Almost always, they're lying. Almost always, they were at that Rockies game or wherever they were spotted, or they were in a bar, or they were on the internet at work and found in an X-rated site or a child porn site. When these things come about, though, the polygraph becomes a very important aspect of keeping tabs on them. Or it's also used to clear up a past deceptive test. If they've had problems on a prior polygraph, they'll work through that with the therapist and the PO for a period of time and then come back into our offices to try and clarify that exam. The monitoring polygraph, to monitor their behavior, usually deals with more of the criminal aspects of their behavior, sexual contact with minors, viewing of child porn, so on and so forth, and conducted every 3 to 6 months. Provides information on the offender, whether or not he's changing his lifestyle and applying what they're learning in treatment. Provides information on whether they're continuing to engage in high-risk behavior. In Colorado, over the years, when we first started the post-conviction testing, I would say probably 70 to 75% of the individuals coming in for their maintenance and monitoring tests were, in fact, failing those tests and then making admissions to us afterwards. That has changed over the years with the therapeutical process getting better and better, the supervision process getting better and better, the monitoring approach. Now I would guess that failure rate is down to around 35 to 40%. Most of these guys are behaving themselves while on probation and parole, much more so than they were at the beginning of this program. Provides information whether they're continuing to engage. The specific issue exam are used to clarify risk concerns. Should be scheduled when a concern persists and even after increasing surveillance. You still don't want to ease up on these guys just because they look like they're behaving themselves and they're passing polygraphs. You still have to keep the monitoring approach with them, we found. The polygraph is definitely a deterrent. Abrams and Ogard in 86 studied the deterrent effects of polygraph on offenders on probation. Supervision with the polygraph showed that 69% successfully complied with probation, 26% successfully complied with probation when the polygraph was not being used. In exit interviews that we do with these offenders, the thing that we hear over and over and over again, particularly when they're getting to the end of their treatment and they're getting off probation, they're getting off parole, is, you know, at the first I absolutely hated the polygraph. It was the worst thing that ever happened to me. As I went on in treatment, it ended up being one of the best things because I knew I always had that polygraph facing me 3 to 6 months down the road, and there were so many times I was tempted to do certain things, to ride the bus and sit next to a minor, to get chummy with a minor somehow, to groom a minor, to view pornography, to go into an X-rated establishment. But I knew I had my polygraph coming up, so it became a 24-hour leash for me. It told me not to do these things because I was going to have to answer for it. And that's one thing we consistently hear from these guys as they're getting near the end of their treatment. Examiner qualifications, real briefly. Polygraph is not something, especially with post-conviction sex offenders, that can be done part-time. You get a lot of law enforcement agencies sending out guys who are retiring from the law enforcement agency who want to just do this part-time. They want to run one, maybe two a month, and it can't be done like that. The interviewing and interrogation skills, particularly with this population of offender, has to be kept up to date, and you have to keep up with it. When I leave to office for a week or so, it takes me an hour or so to get back into the flow of things with these guys. It's not something that can just be done part-time basis. It has to be done regularly. In Colorado, we say a minimum 150 criminal issue exams before you can start doing this type of test, 40 hours of specialized training every 3 years. Implementation considerations, developing procedures, educating therapists, developing sex history questionnaires, setting examiner qualifications and requirements, videotaping exams is a must. This population of offender, we found out right off the bat, will tell us one thing and will go right outside the office and tell the PO or tell the therapist something completely different. They may admit to us that they assaulted their 12-year-old daughter, walk out and say, I didn't tell him that, or he misunderstood me. Well, it only took about our first 10 tests to realize we have to videotape every single one of these guys because of that. Develop a system to track and use the results, educate the stakeholders, and develop consequences. The developing the consequences is very important. On a summary, value of polygraph testing and risk assessment increases the information. That's the number one thing on past offenses. It evaluates the treatment effectiveness and compliance and evaluates the risk of child contact. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you. I do have a question reference. Majority of what you're describing here was done at least at the end during a probationary period, right? When the
polygraph exams, right, themselves on post-conviction. Actually, it starts shortly after treatment. About 2 or 3 months in is when they're going to have their first polygraph. We don't want to do it right off the bat with these individuals because a lot of times, as I said, they rationalize their behavior and they don't know exactly how many victims they've had because they don't see a lot of the people that they've done things to as victims. So we want them to work with a therapist for a while. We also want them to fill out their sexual history questionnaires before we see them for that exam. The exception is the denier, the person who's in denial. We can see them the first day of treatment and get them out of denial because the quicker we get them out of the denial, the more they're going to be recipient to the treatment program itself.
Yeah, follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Senator Hogan.
My thought is one of skepticism. Okay, let's say that probation is completed. Okay, I'm assuming, and my question is based on the assumption that the people that you're polygraphing are masters of deceit. Okay, probationary period's over, then what? How would you characterize their conduct after probationary period? The polygraph is not, the videotaping is not, and they're on their own.
They're on their own. Kim actually could speak to that because they've looked at those statistics in Colorado. After these individuals do get off probation, after they do get off parole, after they've been through the treatment process, all the polygraphs, everything else. Now, and depending on how long they've been on probation, 4 years, 8 years, or lifetime supervision. Many of these individuals are on lifetime supervision, which means they are always going to be under the thumb of the judicial system. But if they're given 4 years and they're off, we have found a decrease in their offenses in the state of Colorado, but she would have to speak to the numbers on that. But you're right, once they're off probation, once they're out of these treatment programs, unless they're doing it on a voluntary basis, which we have had some people do that, they still want to voluntarily come in every 6 months and take a polygraph to show everyone they're still not reoffending, especially family members or someone else they're being incorporated back into society with.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Question of geography.
Jeff, I mean, in Colorado, do you have centralized places where these people on probation come to take the tests? If so, how many or how far the distances that these probationers have to travel to?
To present day, there's approximately 25 sex offender polygraph examiners in the state of Colorado, and they are quite spread out. Some live in the south, some live in the west. We're pretty centralized where we're at. We also have offices in different parts of the states that we do testing in. The rural areas, however, way down in southwestern Colorado, it takes a lot of travel time for an examiner to get there, but they still do it on a regular basis. They still have these examiners come in. Where the difference is they may have 24 of them lined up in a week to take a polygraph examination versus with normal programs, they'll stretch them out over several weeks. In those areas, however, because the polygraph examiners are traveling, they'll just put them all in one lump in a few days' time to test. But you do get the examiners to them. You have to, even in the rural areas.
How much time does it take for a typical test?
Approximately 90 minutes to 2 hours with most exams.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It.
Thank you.
Looks like Peggy's next, huh? Now, Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, just for the members here, the ANWR vote was 49-51 in Alaska's favor.
In Alaska's favor.
Hey.
Peggy, you probably probably have a totally awake committee now. Yeah. We were all watching that vote very carefully. We do appreciate you being here, Peggy. If you will put yourself on the record for us, we're eager to hear your testimony today as well.
For the record, I'm Peggy Heil, and I'm going to be talking about the role of treatment in the containment model. So We just kind of want to transition from polygraph testing and talk about how treatment and polygraph testing interact. Polygraph testing is not a standalone tool. It's not a total answer to the problem. It needs to be combined with the other services. And you only have 3 questions on the polygraph test, and you may have 6 months between times when you're doing the testing. If issues are raised on the polygraph test, there needs to be follow-up on what is going on, what's the reason why there's deception. You need to be talking to family members, possibly employers. It needs to be discussed in treatment. Supervising officers need to start doing some checking up. And that's part of that putting the boundaries around the offender and trying to find out whether they're complying with their conditions. What we find is that polygraph testing alone does not produce as much information as polygraph testing combined with treatment. And treatment alone does not produce the same amount of information that you get when you combine treatment and polygraph testing. So the two together are fairly effective. One of the issues that you have to figure out when you start using polygraph testing is what you're going to do with the information that they reveal, particularly the past crimes that they've committed. And in some jurisdictions, what they have been able to do is work out agreements with the prosecutors that as long as the individual is continuing to participate and progress in treatment and comply with their supervision requirements, that they will not prosecute on the past crimes. But they go ahead and collect the information on who the victims are so that they can provide treatment services to those victims who were previously unknown as victims. So that's the advantage of that option. What, unfortunately, it's very difficult, especially in Colorado. Each jurisdiction has an elected prosecutor, and to go around the state and get agreements from everybody that they will grant people limited immunity is very difficult, and it's not a very popular thing sometimes for a prosecutor to say, oh yeah, I'm not going to prosecute on past crimes that I know about. So another option that is used very frequently is through this process to only ask what is the gender of the person that you victimized, the age of the person that you victimized, and the relationship, so that at a minimum you are collecting the patterns of offending behavior that they engage in. And that can help you prevent future crimes by knowing if children are a risk factor, you're going to set conditions that do not allow them to have contact with children. And you can see there's a variety of options that have been used in the past.
Guess.
In cases where you've provided immunity and so you have the victim's information and you do outreach to the victims, has that been beneficial and welcomed by the victims? I mean, are we seeing that it's worth it to provide immunity to actually get more people into treatment or at least reach out to victims?
I personally don't have experience with that because we went to our district attorney's counsel and discussed these options. Since we're a prison, we would have had to work with all the prosecutors. And after much debate, we all agreed that probably not collecting the information was the best option given our situation. In Oregon, they have worked out those agreements. And I think primarily when you are dealing with children, and getting them the services can be very beneficial. When it's adult victims, you know, they have the option to report and they may see it as an intrusion. I think many times people wonder why you would waste resources on treating sex offenders. There's no cure, so why are you bothering? And there are many benefits to treating sex offenders. You are working on helping them change their behavior. They're always going to know how to commit an offense again. So there's nothing you can do to take away their skills in being able to do that. But what you can focus on is the thought process that they have that leads them to make the decision to commit an offense, and teach them other skills for changing their thinking, changing the choices that they make, developing other behaviors that may substitute for what they're doing, the motivations for offending. At any point, they can continue not to apply, they can choose not to apply what they're learning. So you want to set conditions, and that's where supervision and polygraph come in. Set conditions to try and make the choice to use the tools that they're learning a more desirable choice than to go ahead and reoffend. The other thing that we do in treatment is the amount of information that we learn about their patterns can lead to better supervision criteria so that we're keeping them out of risk pools. And we're seeing the behaviors. We document the path that they take that leads to offending. And if supervising officers know that, and they know early on that buying a puppy is a step towards, you know, trying to attract children, they can intervene at that step where the puppy is bought and put controls to reduce the chance that the person will actually offend. The other thing that can happen with the information that we learn is that if they do offend, and you can see there are many victims in their history, so if they start to offend again, there's probably going to be many more victims. So the sooner we can recognize that they have reoffended, if we catch them on the first one, versus in these studies, 184 before they were found out to be a sex offender, we want to intervene at that first one and catch them and contain them. And then the last benefit of treating sex offenders is that sex offenders know how they groom and manipulate, how they have kept this secret for so many years, how they set people up. And that is valuable information for law enforcement, it is valuable information for victim programs, and it is valuable information for prevention programs. So one of the things that we did in our treatment program is offenders had to do community service projects by explaining how they set up their crimes and what they would recommend for prevention programs. And this is something that we gave to law enforcement and prosecutors and victim programs. And this is all descriptions of different types of sex crimes and how they set them up. And that can be very beneficial. It's adding to the knowledge of offending behavior. Oh, and I don't have my pointer. Can I use yours? This slide really illustrates the difference between combining treatment with polygraph testing. These inmates right here were in the second phase of a treatment program. So they had about 9 months of treatment that met 4 days a week, 2 hours a day, at the point that they took the polygraph test. And you can see the amount of information that they revealed during the polygraph testing process. The parolees had not participated in treatment in the institution. They had recently gotten back out into the community, so they were just beginning treatment and supervision. And the deception rate was about equal in both groups, but the parolees were deceptive and they really didn't tell what was going on because they were not very advanced in that treatment process and used to giving up information and seeing the value of working with the system. Sex offender treatment with the offense-specific treatment is very different than traditional treatment. Traditional mental health treatment, you have a client that you're doing therapy with, you build a trusting relationship with that client, you accept whatever they say their situation is, you're very non-judgmental, you may talk about their choices that they make, but you allow them to make whatever choice they want to make. You guarantee them confidentiality. You don't tell anybody what happens in that office. And you focus on insight about past behaviors. If you look at pleasurable behaviors, things that we enjoy, sometimes we can know why we do that let's say, eating desserts. We may know why we choose to order a dessert, and we may know that we're trying to lose weight and that it's not healthy for us, but we can still choose to order that dessert. Insight does not necessarily stop us from that behavior. People know why they smoke, they know it's not healthy, but they may still choose to smoke. This is a pleasurable behavior for sex offenders. Insight is not sufficient to stop the behavior. You really have to focus on their present choices, thoughts, decisions, behaviors. You need to check that they are changing their behaviors, not just understanding things. You limit the confidentiality so that you are sharing what you find out in treatment with the supervising officer, with the polygraph examiner, and you are collecting information from them. You are using collateral sources of information to check up on what they tell you to see if it is accurate. And you do not establish a trusting relationship with them. You want to establish a therapeutic relationship, but not a trusting. You do want to check up on what they're saying. The other part that is built into sex offender treatment is accountability. And that is not in traditional treatment. You recognize that the client has choices, but it is a value-laden therapy. Certain choices are not acceptable. Choices to hurt people are not acceptable. And you convey that value to them. And what you need to do is set up consequences if they make choices that lead them down the offending path. So the consequences need to be established ahead of time, and they need to be immediate and regularly used. So when you're doing traditional therapy, the client, the person in your office, is the client. But when you're working with sex offenders, the public really becomes the primary client, safety of the community. But you are also trying to help the sex offender build a better lifestyle that does not include harming other people. So is treatment effective? This is a study that was done by the Washington State Institute for Public Policy. That is just a group that evaluates whether tax dollars are well spent on certain activities. And so they did a study and looked at different types of treatment and the impact on sex offenders. And what they found is if you use the psychotherapy, which is the traditional mental health treatment format with sex offenders, without any treatment, they would have a recidivism rate of 6.4%. If you give them supervision and you add psychotherapy while they're in supervision, you can see you increase their recidivism rate from just supervision alone. So it has a detrimental effect. What we do is cognitive behavioral treatment. It's a focus on the thoughts that they use, changing the distorted thoughts and changing the behavior. And what you can see is you cut recidivism in half when you use this type of treatment. What is very important is that the treatment is lengthy and intense. This is a well-ingrained behavior. Kim talked about that. They've had this secret for years. They've successfully convinced people that they haven't been doing this. And this needs to be intensive and long-term to make an impact. These are people who are immediate gratification oriented, and we are asking them to switch to a long-term gratification oriented lifestyle. And locking them into that pattern through the supervision, through the polygraph testing, through the treatment, the longer period of time that you can do that, the better chance of success you're going to have.
Mr. Elton.
Can I go back a couple of slides on the does the sex offender treatment work? If I remember, Jeff mentioned that Oregon and Washington have the polygraph containment program also. Would under the cognitive behavior type of treatment, would the recidivism rate reflect the ability in Washington State, because of the polygraph program, to identify violations or additional criminal behavior?
So you're asking in...
I'm asking if that recidivism rate is inflated simply because you are better able to identify criminal behavior post-release.
For the purposes of this study, I don't know which... What they did is they looked in the literature for research that was sound enough that they could put it in this kind of formula to analyze the impact of the different types of treatment. And I don't know specifically if they included programs that use polygraph testing. It was just looking at the type of treatment. But I doubt the psychotherapy groups would have used polygraph testing, because that's a more traditional form. Polygraph testing is not a traditional use in mental health treatment. So
we are over, but we can go a little longer, so I hate to tell you to skip any part of it because it's all good, but we do need to start towards a... We got a session at 11.
Okay, I'll just try and show you some impact in Colorado. You can see these are no treatment people who did not have treatment in prison, people who had just the first level of treatment, and people who had both a second level and first level of treatment. And the outcomes, you can see 84 successfully completed their parole period if they had had more advanced treatment, longer period of treatment, versus the people who had not. And those are revocations. And that's a cost savings if you're not having to bring people back to prison. And you can also see violent arrest at 1 year. This is after they discharged parole, if they were on parole supervision, versus people who just walked out of prison without any kind of services. And the worst outcome are those people who did not have treatment in prison and walked out of prison without any follow-up services. The best outcome was people who had treatment in prison and they were released to this containment model parole services. And even after they were off supervision, you can see they had the lowest rate of violent arrest at 1 year. And this is just another study from Washington, so a little different location. You can see that, again, having the follow-up services in the community was very effective in reducing the rate. So having the continuum is important. The other thing that we found, just very briefly, is that when you release people to locations where they are living with their family, many of them had the highest technical violations and reoffense rates, because families don't recognize the seriousness of the problem and sometimes cover for people. We found that putting people in environments where people knew their patterns of offending, saw it as serious, and were willing to report back what they were doing to the supervising officer treatment programs had the best outcome. And that's where community notification can become problematic, because the locations that did that, the people were living together with other sex offenders in houses. The supervising officer was going in there very frequently. They could do more frequent checks and search the whole place because it was a few sex offenders living there. The sex offenders were in treatment, and they knew that they would be in trouble if they did not report the other people's violations in the houses. We also had some community corrections programs where very tight supervision, polygraph testing, tight controls. And when neighbors found out that people were living together in the community, That was a very unpopular thing, and that's the downside with community notification, is some very good public safety programs were shut down as a result of that. There can be some very positive benefits of it also. So based on time, I guess I will.
Questions?
It's kind of an observation that if you're going to release somebody who's a sex offender to a family, before you do that, the family should receive an equivalent amount of training or some training.
Absolutely, which was
or
the point in the slide I didn't go over, okay, was that you need to spend some resources working with these families, getting them to understand the extent of the problem.
Other questions? Senator Huggins.
Thank you. One is the national president of the Psychotherapy Association was here. What would he say, or she, that the reason that it doubled the recidivism rate?
I don't know. That's a very good question. I would have an answer for that, but I don't know what their answer would be.
What would your answer be?
This is not panning traditional mental health treatment. For the majority of people who want to go to treatment, that's very effective. But this is a population that it's very ingrained behavior, very secretive, and you need these extra accountability measures to be impactful with this population.
I'm going to take the leap that nobody has. It's a often asked question in some circles. The business of neutering?
Well, if there are some old studies where they castrated people, usually these studies go back to Sweden. They have very low recidivism rates, but it was a voluntary program, and my guess is it was people who were pretty distressed by their behavior that would make that choice. So it's very hard to assess that. There are medications that basically chemically castrate. They reduce the testosterone. And what they find is that they reduce some of the spontaneous thoughts of desires, urges to sex offend. But as soon as you're presented with a child, it kind of overrides. It's not just a sexual drive that is causing this behavior. There's many other motivations for why they're engaging. The power, the rush, I think there may be some adrenaline of doing something forbidden and feeling very masterful in being able to get away with that. So there are some medications actually that look like they would be fairly helpful to sex offenders in reducing the urges, but they're actually antidepressants. They're the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. So it's a complex, even if you castrate somebody, many offenders molest people. You can get back on hormones. But the other thing that people don't know is that even with castration, people can have a sexual response, continue on with the sexual response.
I just wanted to ask a question. Nobody would ask it. It's commonly asked. I just ask it for
okay.
Information. Thanks.
Thank you very much. We have tomorrow in Judiciary Committee, we'll be working on Senate Bill 67, Senate Joint Resolution 10. If we get to it, are you where you want to be on 117 yet?
No, but thanks for asking.
Okay, so we'll concentrate tomorrow on Senate Bill 67, Senate Joint Resolution 10, and we will, with that, any announcements for your committee, Senator Terry?
No, actually.
Okay, the joint committee meeting is adjourned. Thank you.